Hey, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. December 1st marked the 32nd World AIDS Day. According to its organizers, this annual international event provides the opportunity for people to band together in the battle against HIV/AIDS. This year's theme for World AIDS Day was Communities Make the Difference. It recognizes the essential role that communities have played and continue to play in the response to HIV/AIDS at the international, national, and local levels. Thanks to new treatments developed over the years, testing positive for HIV today is not the death sentence it once was. Doctors say that those who are HIV positive, if tested early enough, follow a strict therapeutic regimen, can live long and productive lives. Today we'll talk about the progress that has been made to help those with HIV/AIDS, as well as the ongoing fight to end this devastating epidemic. My co-host for today's program is VOA's senior health reporter, Carol Pearson. Joining us for today's program are Meg Doherty and Dr. Rachel Bagley from the Department of HIV/AIDS at the World Health Organization and Dr. Eugene McCrae, Director of the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Joining us for our first of two segments are Dr. Meg Doherty, Coordinator of Treatment and Care, and Dr. Rachel Bagley, Coordinator of Key Populations and Innovative Prevention at the World Health Organization's Department of HIV/AIDS. In marking World AIDS Day 2019, how goes the battle against HIV/AIDS? Let's start with you, Dr. Doherty.
This is an important question around World AIDS Day 2019 because we're just on the cusp of getting towards our targets for elimination of HIV as a public health problem, and our targets are for 2020. So this World AIDS Day, we mark the fact that we have nearly 37.9 million people globally living with HIV. Among them, approximately 1 million of those are children less than 10 years old. And new statistic coming out this World AIDS Day is that we have 24.5 million people accessing antiretroviral treatment. This is the life-saving treatment combination of three drugs that can keep people alive and keep their virus suppressed and keep them from transmitting the virus on to other people in the community. However, we still have too many people getting infected. Over the past year, we had 1.7 million becoming new infected. And we have too many people still dying from HIV, approximately 770,000 people in 2018 who died of HIV. So although we're making really great strides, we still have some work to go, and my colleague will speak about some of the issues we have with prevention and certain populations.
Dr. Bagley?
Yeah, so to add on to Meg's comments, we've done amazing. Well, we've made fantastic progress. I think many of us who've worked in this field for years really see a completely different picture than we did 20 years ago, where people are accessing treatment, getting tested in large numbers, and living long and healthy lives. It is really, really remarkable. However, we still do have big gaps and a very, very heterogeneous epidemic across the world. In Africa, really, we've made the most remarkable progress. But outside Africa, some epidemics are still increasing, particularly among what we call key populations. And these are people who face particular challenges to accessing testing and treatment and prevention services. These are men who have sex with men, sex workers, people in transgender populations, people who inject and use drugs, and people in prisons and closed settings. And everywhere, these people from key populations remain often marginalized and not able to access, in the same way, health services. And particularly where they face criminalization, this is adding to problems. And really, we're continuing to see rises in HIV in some of these populations, particularly in low and middle-income countries.
Dr. Bagley, I have a question for you. Why are these people that you mentioned, those in the key population for HIV/AIDS, why are they more at risk?
They're at risk because they are marginalized from accessing the services that other people can obtain, accessing the prevention services, accessing the testing services, and accessing the treatment services. But also, there are factors that make people more vulnerable to HIV. So, for example, people who inject drugs, if they don't have access to clean needles and syringes or methadone programs, unfortunately, HIV can spread very rapidly. Not only HIV, but also hepatitis, particularly hepatitis C. Similarly, for sex workers, if they're not in a situation where they can be protected and supported to use condoms or have access to pre-exposure prophylaxis or testing and treatment, again, they're in a situation that makes them much more vulnerable to HIV.
I would like to get back to the vulnerable populations, but first I'd like to take a look at the trajectory of HIV/AIDS, where we've come. I believe the peak was in 2004, and there has been significant declines in infections since then. And Dr. Doherty, I would like you to address that. And the reason is because when I tell people that we are doing a program on HIV/AIDS, there's very little coverage of World AIDS Day, at least in the United States.
Yes, I think we sometimes forget where we started in the late 80s and early 80s, where it was seen as a death sentence when somebody was diagnosed with HIV. And certainly some of the successes we've had have been so important that now many people don't even think of HIV as a challenge or a risk when becoming sexually active. But certainly right now we've had more than 75 million people have become infected with HIV since the start, and 32 million have died. And this was one of the largest scourges and largest infectious epidemics we had seen in the world. And certainly there was an enormous effort in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s to pull together, to find the science, to find the treatments, to be able to address this infection and actually keep people alive, so that now if people are taking the triple therapy, the three-drug regimen, they can have a lifespan that is similar to those who are not infected. And what we're seeing as people are aging with the infection, that they're having to deal with the comorbidities and the cancers and then the non-communicable diseases that the general population have. So we have made enormous strides, and part of that has been because the UN, the WHO, we put out standards and guidelines. We have helped low and middle incomes have access to the testing and the treatment at very low prices. And we've also set targets so that countries can attain a full coverage and try to reach, as we call this, epidemic control or control of the infection. And right now, on those targets, the 90-90-90 targets, meaning that 90% of people who are infected would know their status, 90% of those who know their status are taking treatment, and 90% of those have a suppressed viral load or a viral load at the level that cannot be transmitted to partners, we're doing really well. We have more than 6 countries, I think, across the world. 3 countries in low- and middle-income countries, including Botswana, Namibia, Eswatini, who've made this target of 90-90-90. And I think it's such an enormous success that people are now living with HIV. The important pieces that we've done is we've been able to bring regimens or drug treatment regimens that are 3 medicines in 1 pill that they can take once a day, and for treatment costs, it can cost less than $70 a day for a year for a treatment for one person. So that means now health systems can actually address their infection and keep people alive.
And you also have Truvada, too, the pre-exposure prophylaxis that will keep people who are at risk, which I would think would be almost anybody who's sexually active, from getting HIV.
Correct. There is Truvada, which is also a component of our treatment. And I do think we definitely have enough regimens now, including a new drug called dolutegravir, where we're trying to bring that drug to children and adolescents who have not been doing very well. But we are looking for newer treatments that are coming down the pipeline and always look for options that might be shorter regimens or regimens that can be taken with fewer drugs, or even injectable regimens, not only for treatment, but for prevention. And the pre-exposure prophylaxis, I think Dr. Bagley may want to say a word about that, because that's her area of expertise as well.
And Dr. Bagley, before you talk about that, We have the tools right now, at least theoretically, to totally end the epidemic. So what's the problem?
I think the problem in terms of ending the epidemic right now is having enough political will and looking towards sustainable systems that can actually address and keep people on treatment for their lifetime.
Dr. Bagley?
Yes, I totally agree with Dr. He, but I do think, to come back to the key population, this is more complex. It certainly does also require political will to support focusing services on populations that are very marginalized and often criminalized. And as you say, we do have the tools, for example, pre-exposure prophylaxis, which has been extremely successful along with treatment in high-income countries like the US. And we're really beginning to see very significant declines in new infections in cities in America where treatment and pre-exposure prophylaxis are being rolled out together in the communities of men who have sex with men. This is not, unfortunately, happening in other parts of the world where services for key populations, for MS, for men who have sex with men, don't receive this attention and don't often have the voice and the political will behind them to deliver services for these populations. They often remain hidden and feel very excluded from health services.
Dr. Bagley, you were talking about the pre-exposure prophylaxis and the medication Truvada was mentioned. Over the past summer, here in the United States, the company ran an extensive television campaign for their medication. What significance do you think that might have, the fact that it's going pretty much mainstream, where even though it targets a small segment of the population, it's being seen by everybody? So there is an awareness growing.
I think that's very positive. I think to allow people to have the knowledge that pre-exposure prophylaxis PrEP is really effective, accessible in the US, and particularly if it reaches those people at most risk. And as always, there are inequities in access and inequities in getting that information out to people who most need it. I know in the US, as I say, there have been fantastic gains uptake of PrEP, but there are groups who access it less and are probably more at risk than others. So, for example, young men who have sex with men, young men from different ethnic groups, from African-American young men, and are often not so able to access services.
And what about adolescents? I mean, you said young men, but let's talk about teenagers and preteens. And it would seem to me that they are the most vulnerable group worldwide. They don't see doctors on a regular basis. They don't control things like that. They may be reluctant to talk to their parents. They may not know where to go. And they probably don't know that they have HIV.
This is definitely a real issue, not only in the US, but everywhere. And if we're going to support knowledge and increase access to services for adolescents, we have to get with the times and support them through the social media and platforms like that, that they can access information. And this is something that's taking off, and not only in the US, but across Latin America, parts of Asia. Social media is really including messages about HIV and PrEP. But also, even if they have that awareness, we also need community-based organizations and networks to support them to come into services. It may not be acceptable for them to come to a normal, regular clinic at the opening hours, which don't suit them. So having ways that they can access services in the community by peers from their own community who understand their needs, can be flexible, see them regularly, use new media and mobile ways to contact them when they run out of pills or need a test. A lot of exciting things are happening, but we really need to increase this and listen to the voices of adolescents to see how they would like to see services. And provide information in schools, having comprehensive sexuality education, which makes adolescents from the LGBT community feel accepted and not stigmatized. With that awareness of HIV and other sexual and reproductive health issues is really important.
Dr. Meg Dougherty, Dr. Rachel Bagley, I'm afraid that's all the time we have right now. Thanks so much for joining us today to talk about this disease and for sharing your insights.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Meg Dougherty and Dr. Rachel Bagley from the Department of HIV/AIDS at the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. I'd also like to tell you that a new VOA English app for both Android and Apple devices has been developed, and we encourage you to download and use them. You can find them at the Google Play Store for Android or Apple's App Store for their devices. We also hope you'll get in touch with us through either Facebook or Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or by sending us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. We're back with today's Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. This past Sunday, December 1st, was World AIDS Day. So today we're talking about the progress made to help those with HIV/AIDS, as well as the ongoing fight to end this devastating epidemic. I'm joined in studio by my longtime colleague and VOA senior health reporter, Carol Pearson. Our guest for this segment of our program is Dr. Eugene McCrae. He's the director of the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. McCrae, what is the CDC doing in the fight against HIV/AIDS?
CDC's involvement with the AIDS crisis is actually very longstanding. My program is called the National Programs for HIV/AIDS Prevention. And we are specifically involved in supporting state and local health departments, community-based organizations, and other national organizations to support prevention efforts related to the epidemic. And specifically, we get involved in ensuring that people get tested for HIV, and testing being the gateway to both prevention and treatment. And for people who end up testing positive for the virus, we ensure that those people get quickly linked to care and on treatment, and because we know that treatment is effective in preventing transmission of the virus, and now we know that treatment is prevention. For people who test and they test negative and they're involved in risky activities like having multiple sexual partners, for example, those people are eligible for prevention interventions like combination prevention interventions like condoms and something and a medication now that can be used to prevent acquisition of HIV called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. And then the other thing that we do, once people are on treatment, we also support programs that help them stay on treatment so that they are sustainably virally suppressed. And what I mean by that is that we want to keep them on treatment so that the virus in their blood is low enough so that it's suppressed. And what that does is keep them healthy and it basically prevent them from transmitting HIV to others via sex or injection drug use.
Dr. McCrae, the CDC is known also for being involved internationally in helping to train people or to monitor diseases or to provide help wherever help is needed. Does CDC have a role outside the U.S. in terms of helping countries with HIV and to contain it?
Yes, the CDC definitely has a role globally. We have another division at CDC called the Division of Global HIV and Tuberculosis Prevention. And that division is basically working to support our global efforts around HIV prevention. And what they do is they have programs in multiple countries around the world with a huge concentration in sub-Saharan Africa, which is a part of the world that's very much affected by HIV. And a lot of their work in Africa are focused on prevention and treatment. For example, in 2018, the majority of the 23.3 million people that are on HIV treatment in sub-Saharan Africa, many of those people, about one-third of those people, are actually supported by the CDC global program. So yes, we have a major effort. And that effort includes working very closely with national AIDS control programs in these countries, training both staff in those programs as well as staff people in the community to really provide prevention and treatment for HIV.
Doctor, how important is testing and how effective and accurate are today's tests? And also, who should be tested? And what are some of the challenges that the CDC faces in getting people tested?
Yeah, there's a lot of questions in there. So let's first talk about testing and why is it important. I stated earlier that testing is the gateway to both prevention and treatment. Every person between the ages of 15 to 65 in the United States, if they've never had an HIV test, should be tested for HIV so that they know their status. If a person is involved in, is sexually active and involved in behaviors that put them at risk for HIV, then they should get tested at least annually, in some instances every 3 to 4 months. But testing is critical because it really helps you. If you're negative, you can do things to prevent acquisition of HIV, like use condoms, like take PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis, or if you're a drug person who injects drugs, you can get onto REN services programs and things like that. If you are infected, of course, you can get on treatment to stay healthy as well as prevent transmission to your sexual partner. So testing is critical. Testing these days is very easy. There are many tests available in the market that are very reliable and can test people to determine that they're infected, and they're easy to do. We also have available on the market now at least several home-based test kits that are approved that people can actually test themselves in their home, in the privacy of their home or whatever, and then based on the results of that test, they can then go in and see their doctor to get that test result confirmed. So testing is very easy. In addition, we have at CDC on HIV.gov and on our own website what we call a test locator, where people can actually go to our website or go to their many state HIV websites and find out where they can go in their state or in the U.S. to get tested for HIV. So we've done a lot to make testing as easy and as available as possible to most people.
Dr. McCrae, the final part of my question was, what are some of the challenges you've seen in working with the CDC in getting people tested? Again, yeah, there are stigmas attached to getting tested and so forth.
You're absolutely right. Some of the challenges that we see regarding testing include stigma. Stigma is a major one. So we're doing a number of things to try to address stigma. The other challenge is access. Even when people are living in rural communities and in certain communities, they may not know or have the ability to get tested in their communities and may have to travel outside their community to get tested. So access is another problem. But I think a bigger challenge, which is impacted by stigma, is providers not being willing to test people. Our director of CDC refers to something called provider fatigue, meaning that providers should be asking their patient about their risk, that is doing a sexual health exam and making sure people get tested. We believe that testing should be routine, meaning for us that when somebody walks into a doctor's office and they get a blood draw for any reason, let's say to check their blood sugar, a reflex testing should occur, meaning that if that person comes into a clinical setting and there's no documentation that person has ever had an HIV test, that person should be routinely tested for HIV, and so that the doctor isn't having to make the decision offhand. So it's something that we are working with a lot of clinical providers and clinical facilities to implement routine testing in clinical setting.
Now, where HIV is spreading rapidly is among African-American men who have sex with men, and also African-American women. There's also, it's spreading in certain areas in the Hispanic community much faster than it's spreading in the white communities. So how do you address these issues? These people are hard to get at. There's a huge stigma, and they are often poor, and they're members of minorities, and they lack access.
Yeah, we've made tremendous progress in the U.S. in terms of decreasing HIV infections over the last decade or so, but things have stalled. And as you mentioned, we've seen decreases in many groups, but there are several groups where we're continuing to see increases. And for African-American men who have sex with men, it's sort of stalled, but we continue to see increases in the 25 to 34-year age group of African-American men who have sex with men. Also, we're seeing increases in Latino men who have sex with men in the 25 to 34-year age group. It's almost a 65% increase, a 68% increase. In women, HIV has been going down, especially among black women, where we've seen the largest decrease. But black women still represent the largest proportion of women. When you look at all women affected by HIV, black women represents well over 50% of those women. So we still have a significant disparity between HIV infection in black women versus white women. And so what do? We know that community engagement is critical. If we're going to make a difference moving forward, we have to engage the community in developing solutions that work for them. And I don't really like to talk about communities as hard to reach. Those communities are there. We just need to engage them in the planning for the programs that will work for them. And that's why this year's theme for the World AIDS Day for UNAIDS is actually called Communities Makes the Difference. And for us in the U.S., the theme is Ending the HIV Epidemic Community by Community, which emphasizes the role of community in addressing stigma, because we know that stigma prevents people from getting tested. It prevents people, even after diagnosis, from getting on treatment. It means working with the community to develop testing programs and prevention and treatment programs that work for them. And it also means being innovative and taking out services to where people are. For example, if you've got a group of homeless people that are at risk for HIV or infected with HIV, we need to be taking services to the street where they are, rather than expecting them to come into a clinic or come to some place where they don't feel comfortable. So really, we believe strongly that communities will help us get to where we need to be. So making sure we engage those individuals in the planning, in the implementation, and the support going forward is going to be critical.
Doctor, at one time early on in the AIDS crisis, getting a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS was pretty much a death sentence. And I've seen over the years that there has been tremendous progress in the development of treatment. What are some of the most important forms of treating HIV/AIDS?
Treatment has been very effective. And, you know, starting in the late 90s, when what we call highly active antiretroviral therapy became available, it was basically combination treatment with three or more drugs. It ended up being very effective, and we've seen death rates decline by more than almost 70% since the late 90s when we started using PART. And we've really come a long way. Starting in the late 90s, people had to take multiple drugs, five, six, sometimes as much as 16 pills a day. Now treatment is so easy. You can take one pill a day with very few side effects. And so treatment now is really, really very easy. And so there's no real excuse now for not getting people on treatment immediately and then doing what we need to do to help keep them on treatment so that they can stay healthy and keep their virus suppressed. And the other thing, too, is that the biggest challenge that we're having now is we do a really good job getting people diagnosed and getting them linked to treatment. But once they get in treatment, the challenge we have is keeping them on treatment. So we are beginning to do a lot of work to look at our systems to make sure our systems are responsive to the needs of the clients, meaning that we need to make sure our services are culturally appropriate, especially for Black and Latino persons. And we need to also make sure they're culturally appropriate and receptive to youth and to some of our populations like transgender persons, et cetera. And then we need to have alternatives available to folks who are diagnosed. Everybody may not want to come into a clinic to get treated. They may be willing to see a doctor once a year, but we need to make sure other options are available to them so that they can get treatment in their community or in their community health center or in other places by their primary care provider, et cetera. So we're trying to also make treatment much more available to individuals so that they don't have to go to a clinic to get everything that they need.
Why isn't HIV testing a routine part of any physical? Why do you have to ask for it and agree to it specifically?
That is something that is not required that you get informed consent to do an HIV test. HIV testing should be routine, and we wrote that in our guidelines that were released in 2006. The challenge we have is getting people to implement the guidelines that have been there since 2006, even though in some instances people are very, doctors, clinicians, and hospitals and others are well aware of the guidelines. It's not being done because of biases and other reasons that providers may have, assuming that, you know, you can look at this person is not at risk. So what we are learning is that in places where they've done a really good job getting people tested, they have basically made testing routine, and it doesn't require a provider intervention.
Dr. Eugene McCrae, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights in the battle against HIV/AIDS.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Eugene McCrae, the director of the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia.
And that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. Thanks so much for listening. I'd like to thank my colleague and VOA senior health reporter, Carol Pearson, for co-hosting and helping us put together today's program. Also, thanks to our studio technician, Misha Dubinsky. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castillo next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.